This is Monday, February 13th, 2012. It's the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. I am opening a work session on the Oregon Health Authority Psychiatric Security Review Board report on need for community placement facilities, forensic patients. And I believe we have Ms. Linda Hammond and Mary Claire Buckley. Greetings.
Good morning. Good morning, Coach Owens, members of the committee. My name is Linda Hammond. I'm the Interim Director for Addictions and Mental Health, and here presenting, along with Mary Claire, the report for the budget note requested on community placements. The Oregon Health Authority was directed to work with PSRB to determine the need for community placements for PSRB patients who are at a level of care where they no longer need the hospital level on an ongoing basis, and provide recommendations to meet this need, including potential needs for different types of configurations of facilities, including 16 beds. OHA and PSRB convened a work group comprising 16 members, including representatives from customers, community mental health program directors, NAMI, DRO, AMH, and PSRB and OSH. Sorry, lots of acronyms. So
you might give the words that go with that for
okay.
One time, please.
I hope I get them all okay. Right after just a couple of weeks of doing this. So maybe Mary Claire, can you give the acronyms, because you'll be better at that than I.
Sure. Addictions and Mental Health, the Psychiatric Security Review Board. NAMI is the National Association of Mentally Ill. DRO is Disability Rights Oregon.
Thank you. Just wanted to be accurate there. The focus of the work has been data-driven, with the following information provided to the group. There was a conditional release referral list, which was from 9/1/11, a statewide map of mental health facilities by type and size with adult residents under PSRB, a map of the number of adult PSRB clients on conditional release in each county in the state of Oregon, and also a statewide list of facility vacancies for PSRB clients. Due to the complexity of the system and the direction of the budget note, the focus work group was isolated to the snapshot of time of the date 9/1/11, so that we could get a real look at the needs of the population. And recommendations are based on that snapshot. And we'll also need to continue to look at caseload growth impacts, as well as HB 3100 and SB 420. Mary Claire will give the findings.
Morning, Co-Chair Winters and Cowan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. With this material, the work group basically looked at this, you know, snapshot. Although we were told by the state hospital staff that, frankly, this was a representative of the population on any given day. So we had 47 individuals that were on that list that we looked at the needs that they posed, and reviewed, as Linda said, the types of facilities that already exist for PSRB clients in the communities throughout Oregon. And based on that review of data, the committee concluded that there was not a need for additional secure residential treatment facilities at this time. In looking at the types of facilities we have currently 73 beds of a secure nature out of 287 designated PSRB beds. So that's approximately 25% of those beds, and the group thought that that was sufficient. What is needed, moreover, would be lower levels of care, a residential treatment home level. In particular, in looking at this population, there was identified a specific need for medical homes because our clients are, you know, posing more complicated medical issues along with their issues around their mental health status. And so that was one of the primary recommendations. We also, in looking at this, thought that it would be in the system's best interest to develop some of these residential treatment homes closer to the areas where we have secures. There are a couple of secure residential treatment facilities in this state that don't have an associated step down with them. And the conclusion of the group was that if we built or developed step downs near them, that people could move through these secures more quickly and therefore also eliminate the need for more of these secure, which are the obviously most highly structured and expensive levels of care. We also found that there was a need for specialty populations such as sex offenders, and a need, however, not to necessarily build homes for that population solely, but to develop resources where these individuals could be incorporated rather than making one facility, which obviously has serious problems in development and siting. And finally, there was a need for dedicated respite beds in this, either in, you know, the all the major communities, or at least on a regional basis, because we believe that we can best avoid the use of the state hospital in times of crisis if you had the ability to place individuals, take them out of their particular residential home and put them in a crisis bed to deal with that issue on a short-term basis rather than sending them back to the state hospital. So the group concluded that it would be best for the development of those types of facilities as well. And finally, to develop more of the what we call intensive case management, also ACT team type facilities for or supports for people who then can step down from the residential treatment homes to a lower level of care. So those were the basic recommendations that came out of this work group, and would be happy to answer any questions about that.
Thank you, Chair Winters, and thank you for doing this work. And I apologize, I have not completely read the report, so this answer may be in the report. My question is, as you started your analysis, what assumptions did you make? Did you make the assumptions that the state mental hospital that here in Salem, the new one, was completely open, all beds were open? And did you make the assumption that the Junction City Hospital was open or going to be open at a certain number as you did this analysis?
Representative Freeman, we did not take up the issue of Junction City at all. What this was we took a date in time on September 1st, asked the hospital to give us the names of the individuals who they thought on that given day were no longer, in the treatment team's opinion, no longer in need of a hospital level of care. And then from there, looked at their needs, that we applied, basically used a tool to develop that each one of them was examined on, assessed by this tool to determine what particular needs they might have. We didn't consider, we were just looking at what these people needed to get out of the hospital on that given day.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
One of these days everybody will get used to our name. Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give us some sense of the relative cost of keeping someone in a state hospital bed for 24 hours as opposed to keeping somebody in one of these step-down facilities that you're recommending that we add, or on a respite basis, having the option available on a respite basis?
Co-Chair, Senator, we can get that information on the respite piece for you. We don't have a lot of these respite beds at the moment, but we can certainly get that comparison for you.
And what about just in general? I mean, you're recommending opening more of these step-down facilities, which intuitively seems to make sense, but I'm just interested how much it costs us to keep a patient, one of these people, however you want to refer to them, who's under your jurisdiction, in the state hospital for a day versus keeping them in one of the step-down facilities and being able to move them on out of the secure residential treatment facilities into the next level down.
Co-Chair Senator, we do have all those costs to give you. We can give you the cost of hospital compared to secure residential treatment to housing assistance, and we can we'll be happy to provide that information for you.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Cowan.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I'm curious, reading through the recommendations as to the reason that the that specifically we called out the need for the step-down facilities to be in close proximity to the secure residential facility or the secure facility, and I guess perhaps secondarily to that, if we had more of the crisis respite beds available closer to the step-down facilities, would you still see a need for that step-down facility to be geographically located close to the secure facility?
Representative Cowan, the theory on that is that these individuals who are placed in the community develop relationships. Even in a secure environment, they receive passes and start participating in community over time for example, going to AA meetings or whatever and establishing something. Without having a step down nearby, it requires, when they're ready to leave, for them to be removed from that community and maybe have to move even to a different county or, you know, a different part of the state, because those, in several of these communities, there are secure facilities, which are the lockdown, and then the next step would be a foster home or supported housing. And for many of our clients, that's a rather large leap, because foster homes, as you're aware, you know, are off duty 11 to 7, and then they often sometimes have 4-hour home alone privileges as well. So there isn't as much supervision as in a residential treatment home or a facility where the staff is there 24/7 awake. And so in the areas where we do have, you know, residential treatment facilities and they, you know, have that partnership, the movement, you know, they've already established, and now in Clackamas County, it's the same agency that is going to be running our RTH as runs the secure. And so they have that consistency in treatment. The psychiatrist may well be the same when they step down or what have you. And so we believe that they would move more quickly out of a secure if we had that continuum of care in the communities where these secures are located.
Follow up.
Thank you. So I guess my first thought was, as opposed to returning to a community of origin, if you will, where there might be family support systems or that kind of connectivity to the community where they originally lived. But I think what I hear you describing, and I just want to make sure I was correct, that you're talking about individuals who have been in a secure facility for a long period of time and may not have that connection to a different geographical location.
Representative Cowan, exactly. And in fact, we do allow people who want to go to their, you know, back to a community to certainly be evaluated by their home community. But for those who don't have that kind of support or connection, it
Thank
just...
Thank you. That's helpful.
Representative Clark.
Thank you so much for the report. Really appreciate it. And just... I know, Linda, that you said you were going to get us a list of the costs of what the step-down facilities are. Could you also provide a list of what the costs are for those facilities that have to provide a medical level of care, and then what is actually available for federal match and what isn't available for the federal match? Because I know with some PSRB clients and with certain that all clients and all costs are not uniformly eligible for a federal match. So I think that that's important. And also, I think another piece of information that would be
really helpful would be what the cost is of keeping someone who's critically mentally ill in hospital facilities. So, for instance, in Lane County at Sacred Heart, we have the Johnston unit where we've got people staying there for extended periods of time, and what the cost of that is per year compared to what it costs to keep someone in the state hospital, because I think we need to make sure that we're not just looking at numbers and making assumptions that there are federal matches or there is savings if there isn't, or if there are savings, that we're putting people in the right place of treatment. And then also, so that's a request, and then a question would be, although this particular report, because it wasn't the scope of the report, doesn't deal with whether or not to build Junction City, I've seen other reports that are specifically done on whether or not to build that other hospital and why, or the reasons why we made the change from a 360-bed facility plan to 172-bed facility plan. That might be helpful to give the committee, because it seems that maybe that's information that people seem to be wanting to have access to. So that could be forwarded as well. I think that would be really helpful.
Co-chairs, Representative Hoyle, absolutely. We can talk about the different levels of care between hospital and community, which is a very different model of care, and also the impacts moving from a 360-bed to 174-bed and the assumptions that we made of increased community capacity associated with that relook that we did in 2010.
Great. Thank you.
Co-chair Freeman.
Great, thank you. And also, if we're going to start down that path, let's make sure the committee realizes the number of beds that are not open in the new hospital just built, because we can't fund the positions. I think it's important to connect all the dots if we're going to talk about them.
Well, if we're going to go down that pathway, then seriously, because if you're going down that pathway, then you're also talking about, and they're not here today to weigh in, but how that relates to DOC, because Junction City parameters are more than just the state hospital, and I need to put that on the record. So you would have, in order to get the global picture, you would have to also have that DOC portion. But I believe, Mayor Claire, that you mentioned sex offenders. Mm-hmm. What percentage of the population is sex offenders? You don't have to get it for us today, but if you can bring that back, and it would, because we're dealing with I know on DOC side an aging population, it would be helpful if you had a part of the snapshot of what we're looking at as far as aging. I think some of us are very concerned, because the older the patient or the individual, then we're getting into the medical cost issues. So you don't have to get it today, but it would be helpful if we had some kind of...
Senator Winsor, we'll do that.
Yes. Co-Chair Cowan.
Thank you, Chair. Sort of a follow-up to that commentary, and that was the question that was running through my mind when I looked at your second recommendation around additional medical facilities for persons who have significant medical needs. I know that in the rest of our population, we're watching the demographic changes and the growth of the older population. I have a birthday this week that puts me into that older population. So I'm interested in whether you're finding newer individuals who had been admitted to the hospital with more significant medical problems, or if this refers to the natural process of the aging of the population and the associated medical needs.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Cowan. We definitely are seeing a change in our demographic, and we're definitely seeing an aging of our population, and also the ability of the community through aging and people with disabilities, the DHS side of the care model for our aging population, and then the high level of need and the very specialized need driven by these extreme behaviors that are bringing people in. We're seeing a slightly higher number coming from the community into the hospital because of behavior issues, and we're really working very closely with APD and making sure that when we look at how we move forward, we're giving you a true picture of just not only the needs of the patients, but the cost associated with housing these patients and the sort of models that can maximize federal dollars. But there is not the high level of dollars in some areas that people think there are. There's not always everything in a facility that can be matched. Sometimes it's as low as 38% or 20% of what's paid for. So we're really trying to be thoughtful as we move forward and give a true picture, but we'd be happy to continue to work on that and bring that back.
Thank you. Just quickly,
and I know it's not a part of this report, but I want to congratulate you, Linda, on your interim appointment. We worked with you on the building of the remodel and all the work that had to go into the state hospital, and you've done a tremendous job. And I look forward to the two of you working together on the bill that I managed on the floor, Senate Bill 420. I know you're working on that to implement 420, which, even though it's not, wasn't a part of this budget note, but it's very important work of the, what is it, 114? How many individuals are we talking about?
Senator Winters, as of January 1st, the board turned over 118 cases to the state hospital review panel as tier twos who are currently committed to the state hospital.
So thank you. I look forward to the results of the placement and the movement of the 118. And it would be also helpful because a part of that, as you know, was talking about the difference in cost. As we move that 118 from the amount that we pay in hospital versus the cost when we place them in the community. So I'm very interested in the outcome of the 118. Thank you two very much.
Thank you. Senator Winters, thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Yes, Co-Chair Cowan.
I would move that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge the receipt of a report from the Oregon Health Authority on the need for community placement facilities for forensics patients.
Co-Chair Cowan moves that we acknowledge the receipt of the report. Is there any objection? Hearing none.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I saw Ms. Baker. I'm opening the work session.
Do we need a carrier for this?
I'll take it. I'll carry it.
And your laptop still freezes up.
Work session on Department of Human Services report on alternatives to employment service for individuals with developmental disabilities. I mean, Ms. Erin is not coming up with you. She knows that you're quite capable of doing it on your own.
Thank you.
Ms. Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. This is a report that the agency has brought forward in response to a budget note from the 2011 session. As I noted in my analysis, this program was funded at about 90% of its prior level, and the agency was directed to come back and provide you some additional information on the services and who's receiving the services, and then by July they are to restructure their contracts for the program, and you will hear additional information about that later on, but this is the first report back.
Good morning, Chair Winters, Chair Cohen, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm the Director of Developmental Disabilities within the Department of Human Resources. And thank you very much for the opportunity to come to you today and present progress that we've made towards the budget notes that were directed to us in the 2011 session. This committee may remember that there was significant public testimony provided by self-advocates, families, providers, and others on the importance of alternatives to employment and other structured day activities. And I believe the committee responded to that need, but also had more questions on what is the program to alternatives to employment. And hence, I believe the budget note to us to look at what is the utilization, what is the outcomes, what are the costs, and later to look at how we might structure our contracts to assure the outcomes are being met and delivered. Alternatives to employment is often defined by what it's not, and it's not activities that individuals are engaging in wage-earning behaviors. Actually, our rules claim that it's any service conducted away from an individual's residence that addresses the academic, recreational, social, or therapeutic need of the individual for whom it serves. So in the past, the Office of Developmental Disabilities has collected data information about individuals in their work activity. We use a system called the Employment Outcome System, and providers give us report twice a year, and they look for the full month of March and the full month of September and report on everyday activity. As a result of this budget note, we changed the data information to include information about people who are in alternatives to employment, what is the amount of time they spend there, and what are the activities. So that's what I'm hoping the report will help highlight for us today what that is. If you look at Table 1 in the report, you'll find that of the 4,069 individuals who are receiving services, 83% engage in some part of the month in an activity to employment, to alternatives to employment. So there is a large percentage of people who are spending time doing something that is not work-related. But of them, 60% also are engaged in some work. So it was very helpful for us to see in the data that it's not an either-or type of program, that either you are working all the time or you are engaged in non-work activities. But programs throughout the state have really combined work and non-work programs to support people through the full week of their day. And when we went to Table 2, that was just a drill down to say it's pretty balanced. People are pretty much 50% of their time in work or non-work for those individuals who are in that combination. When they are not in work activities, the types of things that are most reported in our outcome system is that people are engaged in really three primary areas. One is a leisure, things that are structured that keep the person interested and engaged in the day. Secondly is education and skill building. Often they're learning tasks. It may be related to future jobs. It may be related to how to access the community. And thirdly, they're doing volunteer. So they may not be in a paid activity, but they're in a volunteer and doing things that we believe help them get into a path to employment, because employment is still a highly valued and primary sought after activity. And that's what was displayed in Table 3. The demographics, we took a look at our data and said, if you looked at the difference between youth coming into the program, most individuals come in around 21 since they have access to public education up through 21, and they stay in our system through the lifespan. So we looked and thought we might see it really tilted one to one area or another, but the data really shows that alternatives to employment are used by all age group. Not surprisingly, for individuals who are older, more likely they are only engaged in alternatives to employment, but still everyone is somewhat engaged. And we also looked at the acuity level. And acuity we've measured by our support intensity scale, and it's a 1 to 7, with 7 being individuals with the most significant need. And again, not surprising that individuals with the most significant need spend more time in non-work type of activities. But I think the data and being able to look at the data has really presented our office and our community with a much richer picture of what is going on in the programs and how we want to move towards shaping them. The cost per case, there is no difference right now in how we allocate costs, whether it's alternatives to employment or employment. So we have a daily rate of somewhere in the neighborhood of $61 a day. However, we are in the process of rate restructuring, and we're doing that in partnership with our provider community and advocate community, that will look at the intensity level, So again, that scale of 1 to 7 and the setting level. We know we're doing that within the budget that's allocated, so it's not a rate restructuring process that is identifying if it costs more, will we just pay for more, because we understand the context of which we're working in. And that group is continuing to meet and has this year as a target to complete the work they're doing on that. So they're moving forward on that. And lastly, the work group that has been looking at this report with us is continuing to work on how we will measure outcomes. Several of the providers have sent us the documentation they use that tracks the outcome of the program that are it for individuals in the alternatives to employment. We have been seeking all providers to give input because we anticipate meeting the second budget note timeline in July of being able to use those outcomes in a contractual basis. So we're moving forward on that. Can I take any questions?
Chair Freeman.
Thank you, Chairwoman, and thank you for this report. You talked just briefly about the rate structuring and the per day per person cost.
Yes.
It's my understanding recently that changed from a per person per month to per person per day,
yes,
based upon some budget adjustments we made. Can you explain a little
yes,
bit of that?
Yes.
And really, you may not have this number, but I'd like to know what the cost savings or the difference was in those two.
Chair Winters, Representative Freeman, we did indeed go from a monthly rate to a daily rate, but it was not based on cost reductions, and we're actually looking to try and make it cost neutral. And let me see if I can explain. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, 3 years ago instituted a letter that was telling states they needed to go from monthly billings, and at that time they had indicated to 15-minute billing segments. That was a pretty outrageous request, and there was a lot of advocacy to have them look at a more reasonable unit of service. And so they have retracted from the 15-minute, but they left the door open except for monthly. So we have been meeting with them over the last 3 years, and the first thing we did was we changed our case management billing because that had been a monthly. And 2 years ago we did that. Our residential is calculated on a daily, and so we had told them that we would be moving towards a daily rate with this unit. They were here in September meeting on our waiver, and we once again reassured them that we were moving to a different daily, to a different billing matter. What we had to look at in converting from monthly to daily was you had to take into consideration there were going to be absences, there's holidays, so you couldn't just divide the rate by the 30 days or the 5 day a week work day. So we worked with providers to try and understand what is a reasonable vacancy factor or absenteeism, and came up with a 14% to 15%. And we have been looking at billing, and now we're looking statewide, not agency by agency, and I understand different agencies are having slightly different impacts. In the month of October, we were 102% of our budgeted allocation. In the month of November, we were at 94%. So we're looking to see, some months we know we will have higher vacancy rates, some months we will have zero, and we're looking to balance. And we have agreed with the providers this was not done as a cost-cutting measure, that we will try and work to that total budget. So right now, we are pretty much on target for the rate vacancy playing out, but that's at a statewide level, and that's how I'm looking at it. And I know there are some providers who support people who come all the time, and they're seeing a different higher rate, and some who have people who come with a lot of absences, and we're trying to work with them so that they can schedule around if they have individuals with pretty significant medical issues who don't come a lot, how they could look at staffing that might anticipate that.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, and you described the problem fairly clearly. What you end up with is these services, trying to have enough people on staff to handle what could be a potential amount of clients show up on any given day. Right. But we're not funding them based upon the potential that might show up. We're only funding them on who actually shows up. And that really creates a disincentive to do programs like camping and outings for these individuals with their housing people. So you just got this real problem going on. And specifically in my community, part of their last budget cuts, their board decided they would do furlough days, and that would help them with their budgets. But now that this billing thing's in place, it absolutely mitigates any savings for their organizations through furlough days, because they don't get paid for those days anyway. So I encourage you to of course, look at the statewide, but also specific how it's impacting people that are doing this work, because it's very important work.
Chair Winters and Representative Freeman, I also know from specifically from providers in your community, they've also talked that if we could move more quickly on the rate restructuring, because they're based on old models that that prorated, and they believe if we looked at paying higher for people with more needs and less for others, that that might also help. So we continue to work with them.
Let me know what I can do to help.
Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, if I can also take just a moment to reference something that wasn't in the report, but I do want to take the opportunity to make you aware that there has been a lawsuit filed against the state of Oregon on January 25th. And that lawsuit was filed by Disability Rights Oregon, and they were joined by three other attorney firms, Perkins Coie out of Seattle, Miller Nash in Portland, and the Center for Public Representation in Northampton, Massachusetts. The lawsuit is based on a claim that Oregon is over-reliant on sheltered workshops, and they are using the Supreme Court Olmstead decision definition of segregation to say it applies to sheltered workshops. We're disappointed that the suit got filed because I believe we share many values, including supporting people in employment settings, but I do want to make sure the committee is aware that that has occurred. It's new enough that I'm afraid I probably can't speak to it with great depth at the moment, but I did want to make sure the committee was aware of that.
My apologies. I didn't call BAM to see if they were supporting the last action. And so does BAM want to have anything to say?
No.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Co-chair Cowan.
Madam Chair, I would move that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge the receipt of the report from the Department of Human Services on the report on alternatives to employment services for individuals with developmental disabilities.
Co-Chair Calvin recommends that we acknowledge the receipt of the report on alternatives to employment services for individuals with developmental disabilities. Is there any objection? Hearing none.
Hearing.
Freeman, would you like to carry this?
I most certainly would if you'd like me to.
Sure.
You know, while I do carry in bills and full Ways and Means. Try another one.
Ms. Baker, is there anything else for the good of the order?
No. The next meeting of the subcommittee is on Wednesday, so we will have some work sessions on grants and reports for that day.
Any particular time we're going to have it, or just sort of play it by ear?
We believe it will begin at 8:30 in the morning.
Wonderful. Thank you.
My apologies. The combination of weather and other things, actually more Senator Bates' weather.
Members and for the audience who's listening in, we're in a part of the session where things are very fluid, and members often will need to go to testify in other committees and what have you. So I would just say if we're not here, we could be 5-10 minutes late, because this building feels like now that we're at the end of session. And so always at the end of session, we've got a lot of things going on between the chambers and the hearing rooms. And with that, if there's no further...
We're
adjourned.
I hope so.